Welcome to another Cart.ca podcast. My name is Bill Roberts, and with me today is Christian Roberts, managing partner at Nordicity. And Nordicity deals with things like strategy, policy, economic analysis for cultural, digital, creative, and communication industries. And Christian is with us to talk about how COVID-19, this persistent plague, has impacted our Canadian media industry, and what strategies, what thinking is going on with regard to mitigating this pandemic impact. So welcome, Christian, and congratulations on the new job title.
Oh, thanks, Dad. Good to be here.
Yes, we need to straighten that out. All right, Christian, to get that out of the way, it's not an elephant in the room. It's sort of if it's an elephant, it's a very nice elephant. And in the interest of full transparency, as you mentioned, you are related to me. And I am a proud dad to be interviewing you today for Cart.ca. And I guess I should ask, how has being my son been for you, though?
That is not a loaded question at all. No, it's been, between you and my mom, who, just for more sake of clarity, Joan Pennyfather, former government film commissioner, CRTC commissioner, so forth. Canadian media is sort of the family business. And, I tried to escape, tried to go to grad school and think about international relations and all that sort of stuff. But, dragged me back in. But as I like to say when I go to dinner parties and people bring up you or my mom, I was probably the only 8-year-old ever who knew what a Category B TV license was. And probably still the only 8-year-old. But in all honesty, it opened a lot of doors in the early part of my career. And that's a privilege that I didn't necessarily deserve, but one that I try to do some good with.
Well, good. All right. So, for listeners, there might be a clicking sound. This is occurring in Christian's kitchen, under reasonably socially distanced circumstances. And there's a wonderful, shepherd dog here who, his nails might be clicking a bit. But, so Christian, tell our Cart.ca listeners a little bit about Nordicity and what it does and what exactly you do for the company.
Well, I think your intro summed up pretty well. But again, it's one of those things at dinner parties, people ask you what you do, and I say I'm a consultant, and they immediately lose interest. But what we really do is we specialize in the economics of the media industries in Canada and beyond. We're probably one of the only companies that does that. When we think about economics, we help governments and companies and organizations develop policies and strategies to help support those industries you listed before, the cultural, digital, and creative industries.
So you've been advising specific companies and specific organizations on COVID-19 recovery strategies. And some of those companies, I gather, and organizations have been, like the Canadian Media Producers Association, which deals with film and television, CASO, which deals with animation, and VFX, the Canadian Media Fund, of course, film and television, interactive, I guess, Canadian Independent Music, and the Halifax Partnership, also about music. And it looks like COVID-19 will be with us, for at least another several hundred days. Are there pandemic mitigation changes in our audiovisual industries that look like they might become permanent fixtures? Are there new platforms? Is there a new future for linear media such as radio and television? And is the future all about a well-planned digital strategy for arts and cultural organizations?
So, I think I'll cherry pick a few answers out of that, out of those questions. The first one that struck me is the question around digital strategies. And for a long time, I've been droning on about this notion that digital strategy these days is just another word for strategy, as digital is kind of the reality that we all lived in before COVID. But I think, as we all sit around looking at our Zoom screens, that reality becomes more evident than it did before. So I think, I think those companies and organizations are thinking in various different ways about how their digital world that they are sort of forced to live in now is going to continue on. In some ways, it probably will become permanent fixtures. As an example, I don't think that, many interactive companies and animation companies or VFX companies are going to fully return to the kind of office settings that they did before COVID. So I think that kind of stuff is probably here to stay. You asked in there about, is there a new future for linear media such as TV and radio? I don't know about you guys.
So.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I've spent the last couple of months watching a lot of, you know, streamed video over various platforms.
TV viewing is up.
It is, as is, you know, I mean, so both linear and interactive media is going up. So the consumption of media during COVID is definitely something that's going up. And so, you know, so insofar as we continue to live in sort of a supply and demandy kind of environment, you know, we can expect that that demand is going to lead to, you know, to some kind of a future. You know, I think, but I think, you know, on the flip side, you know, some of the issues that were part of that, you know, part of, you know, creating sustainable media industries in Canada that existed before COVID are just, you know, are exacerbated by it.
Right.
But I guess we'll talk about all of that.
Yeah, okay. All right. When we were setting this up, Christian, you were talking about and sharing with me that there's quite a contrast between animation and video games, and to a lesser extent, recorded music, and live music and live action film and television. Tell us a bit about that. You called it the tale of two COVIDs.
Yeah, and I think I started in on that a little bit in my last response. So I think it has to do with how content is created, sort of physically created by the individuals that do so in those two kind of camps. So you take sort of animation and video games, just to, you know, very clear examples. What happened in COVID is, you know, they went home. And they took their computers home, and often that cost a pretty penny for the animation companies. I think, as I recall, there was a picture somewhere of a Vancouver-based animation company, just the picture of how many high-end computers they had to purchase to move all of their 400
right.
staff home. It's like,
yeah.
it's a sight. But once they did so, they were able to more or less create content as they had always done. And as I said before, the demand for that content has never been higher. So, you know, the market did its thing and they were able to make money. And that's, you know, we look at, you know, in video games, you look at, you know, July, I think was the best ever month for US video game sales in the history of time. So, you know, if you're making video games in a market where the consumption of that product has never been higher, it's probably a pretty good time.
Yep.
But the key thing there is they were able to continue to create the content that they had always done. They just had to do it a little differently. You contrast that with sort of live, with, you know, live action film and TV production and live music, where the very creation of the piece of content just couldn't happen anymore. So if you can't make the product, you can't sell the product, you can't make money. So I think that
the technical term is scuppered.
Yeah. So I think that, I mean, those are two very different tales. So I think, you know, it's not that there haven't been challenges, you know, in terms of animation or video games. You know, they can't go to conferences, they can't have meetings, they can't do the same kind of business development. But more or less, you know, they'll figure that part out if you can actually get the content made.
Okay. And what about subscription television? Nordicity does some work in that area as well, I think. And how will COVID-19 affect cord cutting? Even though, as we just said, television viewing has generally gone up, I mean, do you have a sense of what's happening, you know, in the world today on cord cutting and maybe Canada compared to the rest of the world?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know about Canada as compared to the rest of the world, but your question got me thinking about the term cord cutting as a term. I mean, it may no longer be the right thing to call it. I mean, because in some ways it assumes that the natural state of affairs is where you're sort of connected to a BDU, where that broadcast distribution undertaking is distributing your content. But, you know, in that rise of subscription TV, and I guess what we mean about that is subscription video on demand TV, to be more specific, you know, and in Canada, that's the rise of things like Crave, and the other zillion of on-demand services that have sort of emerged over COVID from, you know, global to, you know, all the Canadian players and, you know, increased content being pushed in CBC Jam and so forth, that, like, that is the new normal. Like, as we start thinking about new normals, the new normal is subscription television is, and I think, you know, I can only speak for myself, but I can also imagine that I'm probably, in a pretty good state. I'm spending more on so that subscription television than I was before. So in terms of generating revenue streams, both for Canadian and non-Canadian players, I think, you know, we're doing more. So yeah, there probably is a future. And if anything, you know, that's just TV or audiovisual content distribution these days.
All right. Okay. Speaking of new normals, just before COVID-19 broke out, our Ontario film and television industry was headed for pretty much a bumper crop. Before the mid-March lockdown in 2019 itself was going to be a record year with an estimated something like $2.2 billion in production. But COVID-19 halted production for months now and has put thousands out of work. We're going to dig into it a little bit more, but just in a, you know, reader's, you know, kind of a condensed version, how is the industry doing now?
It's on life support. I mean, again, we're talking, to be specific, we're talking about the part of the film and television industry that deals with the creation of new live action content, right? And that we'll get to why that's important later. But yeah, I mean, it's on life support. I mean, all of the mechanisms that have been used to try to help the industry, you'll see the words emergency and relief and recovery show up frequently. And that's usually what you, those words you apply to, you know, keeping somebody alive rather than helping them thrive or helping them grow or helping them access new markets or whatever. So, I mean, I think that those efforts have been reasonably successful in staving off the worst possible outcomes, you know, the massive bankruptcies that, you know, in March, some parts of the industry were predicting. But I mean, across Canada, it's over $3 billion of production that was halted in March. And that's, again, you know, it was the highest, you know, I don't have Ontario in front of me, but in across Canada, that's the highest rate it had, you know, highest amount of production it had ever been. So imagine going from your best day ever to your worst day ever in like a week.
Yeah. It's a Rodney Dangerfield moment. No respect there. So when you talk about things being on life support, you come to the subject maybe of insurance. So the CMPA declared that about 60% of producers affected by COVID-19 were dealing with insurance issues, and that interruption or the shutdown of confirmed COVID-19 cases was really going to be, or is still, a big, big problem for them. I think that 60% represented a billion worth of your $3 billion. Then the Trudeau government announced late September the 25th, a new $50 million short-term compensation fund for Canadian audiovisual productions. Is that what the doctor ordered? Is that going to solve the insurance problem for Canadian producers?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a life preserver, not a rescue boat, right? It's just something that'll keep them going. It'll keep them from drowning, but probably won't save them.
Is it still the straw that could break the camel's back?
Yeah, I think it might be. I mean, so I think one of the issue, insurance has always been an issue for any, really any creative industry that has a physical presence, you know, be that a music venue or, you know, a production set. But, you know, in pre-COVID, there was a history that actuarial tables could understand, could value that risk. So, you know, what we're seeing now isn't only that insurance is more costly because of all the potential downsides of, you know, being on set with COVID, but because we, you know, those actuarial tables don't include, you know, global pandemics because they haven't had one since they were created, they can't value the risk. So it's less a matter of insurance being expensive than insurance being impossible. So if you can't insure a site, you can't legally work on it because you have, because of very useful things like, you know, union deals that, you know, require the safety of employees. So yeah, I mean, it's a, if not resolved, it may be, a very banal topic that creates a really big impact. And I think the CMPA is probably right to shine attention on it.
Okay. Well, that was one federal program. There have been a few others to assist the film and television industry. The Canada Emergency Response Benefit, the Canada Emergency Wage Subsidy. Have those been working for film and television and video and interactive?
I'd say they work better for some industries than others. And they work better than they did when they started. And I'll start with the second part of that response. Once they were adjusted to include contract labor, things like CERB or the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit, could be applied to the film and TV industry. Because as your listeners likely know, that industry is largely composed of contract labor that work on on various sets. And originally, CERB only applied to, you know, full-time employees. So it was to the entirety of the work that film and television workforce was not eligible. But so, yeah, so the industry lobbied and they got a good response. In terms of the wage subsidy, I mean, again, the structure of the film and television industry with single purpose vehicles created to mitigate the risk of individual productions made it a little difficult to apply because in order to get it, you had to prove a percentage loss in overall global revenues. And if the thing that was making revenue in the first place was that single purpose vehicle, it became difficult to apply. So again, it wasn't a great fit for film and television. I think, you know, the advocacy of the CNPA and APQM and others have changed that and made it a little more useful. But, you know, again, these are things that may keep life support going. They might keep the respirator pumping, but aren't likely to,
they're not the panacea.
There's no cure, and that's no cure for the problem.
All right. Well, what about, you know, paying for things, you know, follow the money, paying for things. Any thoughts on making those digital giants help pay to produce Canadian content?
It's a tricky one. I mean, I think I'll answer personally is that I'd say that baby steps, like what Quebec has done and for, you know, having them pay taxes where they commercially conduct business. I mean, I think those should be, I mean, regardless of if we're talking about Canadian media or shoe manufacturing, you know, a pretty standard thing. If you do business in this country, you should pay at least consumption taxes in this country. Beyond that, it's, you know, whether or not I think it's a good idea to see them pay, I don't see how it would work. Rather, I think if we approach the problem from the other direction, which is to say, helping Canadian companies, people that make that CanCon, produce content that they can, you know, sell to those giants and retain some intellectual property when they do so, that probably puts us in a better place at the end of the day. So we're not getting them to pay for content that they may or may not want. We're helping our folks create content that are, you know, appealing to those digital giants. And therefore we probably get a bigger upside out of that deal as the public.
Now, was that the point of the May announcement, the May 2020 announcement? Canadian Heritage announced a $500 million COVID-19 emergency fund for cultural heritage and sports organizations. And I guess that was about jobs and planning and strategies. And about $115-16 million of that was geared to the audiovisual sector, about $89 million to the Canadian Media Fund and $27 million to Telefilm Canada. As that done the job and had the impact and sort of set the business up to do what you just explained?
I think, yeah, the answer is probably yes and no. It's too soon to tell. And we are having this conversation while Canadian Heritage is surveying the recipients of that very fund as to the impact on their companies. So it's a little hard to gauge.
So the analysis is happening.
It's happening as we speak. Okay. By Canadian Heritage. That being said, I do know that both the Canadian Media Fund, they have been, you know, thinking of new ways of deploying that capital rather than just saying, okay, we're going to, you know, fund more projects. Full disclosure, I think some part of that $88.8 million is what allows us to continue to assess the impact of COVID on companies. So I think
by us you mean Nordicity.
Nordicity, yeah. Yeah. So I think they've been looking at it and trying to be creative with how to deploy those funds. So I don't think it solved the problem. I think that the issue of Canadians owning and being able to exploit intellectual property on a global stage, it will extend beyond COVID. It existed before COVID. It just, as we'll get into shortly, I think COVID really continues to shine a light on the necessity of IP ownership.
All right.
Well, okay. We'll get back to it.
Yeah, we'll get back to that. I'm also wondering about how different companies, Canadian companies, reacted to the pandemic, the plague, to COVID-19. Blue Ant Media, we both have some friends in that world. They pulled together some good, distracting, and binge-worthy TV shows to watch across its various channels, like Cottage Life and BBC Earth. I think that was like an extended free preview offer. Bell Media and others did some pretty similar things. Plus, in terms of, you know, being an ISP, I think they were pretty flexible with regard to payment options for Bell services. Do you have any other private sector players come to mind in terms of the noteworthy or innovative reactions or management of COVID?
I think that the way that, I mean, I go back to those interactive companies or the animation companies, and I think the on-the-fly rejigging of entire workflows, I think that needs to be credited, because they, redoing a couple hundred people companies are very complicated, workflows, and then still being able to create content. I mean, we worked with the, animation industry in Ontario to monitor how they were doing. And basically they, by the time we got to them in early April, they had more or less already figured it out. So that I think is, and that's, there's a number of companies in that boat that we could talk about. But I think at the end of the day, it's not a situation where you can't innovate your way around a pandemic. It is what it is. And I think, the companies that you mentioned, particularly Blue Ant and Bell Media, let's say on the media side, less on the ISP side, they have something in common, which is that they're involved in the distribution of content. And if that's where you fit in the value chain, like, you're probably doing okay. You just need to turn the tap on a little more, provide more free services, get people to watch your ads on
Rogers would be the same.
Coca-Cola. Yeah, exactly. And so, Chorus, it's even the CBC, right? I mean, you're distributing content to viewers. And if that's your thing, you already have the content and your job is to get it to viewers, you're probably going to be okay, because that's the same thing you've always done. Again, the demand is there. No one's stopping watching shows. And the incremental cost for many of those platforms is $9 and $10 a month. So in terms of the value proposition to the customer base, it's pretty good, right? I mean, so I think that's where, it's not, if you have the stuff and you can continue to sell the stuff, you're probably doing all right. And so, yeah, they just kind of turned those that did the best were ones that were able to turn the tap on more.
Now, you slipped in the CBC there in that response. So let's spend a moment on the CBC, Radio-Canada. Last month, they held a live YouTube Facebook streamed public meeting. It featured Michael Goldblum as the chair and Catherine Tate as the president and CEO. And it focused on four themes: trusted news, diversity, creative community support, and of course, kids content. Is there a special role for our national public broadcaster in this pandemic, a different role than the private sector?
Yeah, I think there is. I think there's always been. I mean, I'm going to go back to, before I answer that question more fully, I'm going to go back to your first question, which is what it's like to be your son.
Yeah.
I should also point out to your listeners that I grew up traveling around the world as necessary luggage to public broadcasting conferences. So I may have a slightly biased view as to the role of public broadcasters. I also spent some of my childhood running around the halls of TV Ontario on the weekends, stealing every available highlighter. But so with that in mind, I think I would say that the role that the public broadcaster plays in a time like COVID is the same role it always plays, but the same role it should always play, maybe, is perhaps a better way to say it. I mean, I think for me, the first of those four themes is probably the most important right now, is
trusted news.
Yeah. I mean, you can get good kids content other places. I agree. It's great content, kids content. I mean, I got a 5-year-old. I see that content all the time, but the trusted news that isn't trying to sell, that you can sort of believe isn't trying to sell you something.
It's not spinning something.
Yeah, I think that's the role of a PSO, public service broadcaster.
After PBS too.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I'm, that's why I'm broadening it from the CBC to all public service broadcasters. And I think that, divorcing news with a profit motive is so important these days, probably more important than it's ever been. I think many argue that, the relationship between profit motive and news is the very, is what enables our southern neighbors to be maybe as misguided as they might currently be, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, well, mine too.
In a sense of irony, it didn't start with Fox News, right? I mean, CNN predates Fox News. CNN is really what starts to attach profit motive to news delivery in a really obvious sort of holistic way. All Murdoch did is then perfect the model, right? And it's impressive as it is sort of, you know, stomach churning. But I think that the converse of Fox News is a public service broadcaster delivering news.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've never needed that more. I'd say that diversity is a thing that the CBC probably should have put focus on. I think what that means is
Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
BIPOC, Indigenous.
I that's a good clarification. I don't know how that's going to be actualized to made into actual content or funding for content by the CBC or others. Nerdicity is currently working with the Racialized Media Equity Collective, known as RAMC, to sort of assess the role the data being collected on racialized filmmakers and showrunners and writers and directors and producers in Canada, and ideally the CBC would have a prominent role in that.
So speaking of shows in the future, I get confused a bit about what is actually out there waiting to be done now. I've heard that there's something like 214 camera ready film and television projects. They're primed to go. They represent, you know, almost 20,000 jobs in this country. Is that where we are now? We've got hundreds of projects ready to go,
yep.
Tens of thousands of jobs at stake. And is that going to happen?
Yeah. I mean, it is true. I mean, it is true that when things stopped in March, and then in April and then in May, and so forth, that creates some pent up demand or pent up, it's like a, you know, water pressure in a hose that continues to grow over time. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely there are new projects or those projects that are ready to go. I mean, when you commit funding to a project, it's committed to that single purpose vehicle, right? So that money doesn't go away, or it generally doesn't go away. You know, maybe after 6 months, it starts to trickle off. But then again, there were new projects that weren't slated for March, that were slated for June, that then entered into that pipeline. So, I think it is safe to say that there are hundreds of projects that are ready, that would be ready to go if mysteriously, miraculously enough, this plague was to evaporate. Mind you, it's not going to, but I think that is probably true.
Now, what about overall in terms of the infrastructure of the industry? We've done a great job as Canadians seducing American film and television production in this country. I guess we call it line producing for American shows. Are there any issues now around studio and crew availability? Is US-based production soaking up most of our production capacity just at a time when we have those 214 projects that we want to get going? Is there an impact on Canadian shows?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is. But I think it's important, though, to recognize that was more or less the situation before COVID too, right?
Okay.
I mean, when you go back to that sort of bumper year, the best year ever, that best year ever is fueled in large part by the investment of those American TV shows. And by investment, I mean, they're, you know, hiring line producers in Canada and, you know, making shows for CBS or HBO or Amazon or whatever. Those are all, that was true. But if you then stop that for 3 months, and they were already planning to come up here and do shows, and they can't do those shows in the States, and the States is even worse off than we are. So the demand for those production services is only sort of increased over the sort of 6-7 months since they stopped filming. So yeah, I mean, that a situation where we were already oversubscribed both for crew and for studio space has gotten, you know, it's just gotten worse. So what is likely to happen when the tap turns back on is that those who can pay the most will get the best facilities, if not all the facilities, and the crews, if not the best crews, if not all the crews. So it you know, in a world where domestic producers were already kind of getting squeezed out of the market by virtue of not being able to pay as much as their American counterparts, I think this will exacerbate that pre-existing condition. As I said, many of the problems that we're dealing with now are the same problems we're dealing with before. They're just worse.
So American line production will squeeze out Canadian domestic production in terms of facilities, studio crews, because they can simply pay more.
And it was already true.
Already
true. And it's just going to be more true than it was. So, but I think the hope is that, is kind of in irony, is that the smaller size of many, not all, but many Canadian productions allows a little window for them. Because it is likely, as production has already begun to restart, there are limits on the size of it, on the number of individuals that can be on set at any given time. And if the Canadian producers can get their work done with fewer people than the line producers, there's a window for them to exploit. And I think that's the hope. I also think that, let's call them second tier or jurisdictions like Hamilton as a good example, will continue to benefit from, entirely full sound stages in places like Toronto and Vancouver. So there are opportunities here for Canadian, domestic producers. They're just probably not in Vancouver and Toronto and the big name sound stages with, A1 crews and so forth.
Okay. So that's talking a bit about, let's dig a little deeper there in terms of the nature of production on the other side of COVID-19 or during COVID-19. I think it's been relatively standard in our business, film and television production, that you have a paramedic on the set or on scene. Now it seems that their role is even larger. They're becoming kind of like rock stars, rock star paramedics, where they can walk up to big stars and talk about compliance, masks, temperature checks, physical distancing, get away from the buffet table, et cetera. What are there other things that are happening with on-set production in this changed world? I mean, people working in pods or art departments being handled off-site. And you've referenced this before about the work from home aspect. So is that going on?
Yeah, I mean, I it is. I mean, I think as people try to optimize the set, and what I mean by that in this context is, who do I actually need to be there? And, one of your earlier questions got to, are there going to be lasting effects of COVID? And I think that's one of them, and perhaps one of the most important ones, is people really thinking about what they need to do rather than just kind of going about it because it's what they always did. So, yeah, you mentioned art departments, but it could be, your sort of daily, your rough cut VFX. It could be it's editors that might have been on site. It's shop departments, all these things that might have previously just been part of the same facility are somewhere else. And as you pointed out, and yeah, I do think those are changing how production is made. I don't think there's an answer though yet. I mean, we in Ontario at least, got back to production in some meaningful numbers in maybe June and July. So we've only a couple of months of figuring out how this works. And I don't think they've figured it out. I do think, though, that it poses some opportunity to kind of spread the industry further around, around places like Ontario, around the province, where that internet is sufficient to move large media files back and forth. So if you could shoot in downtown Toronto, but your editor was in Bancroft, I mean, if the internet in Bancroft was sufficiently good, then you could do that, right? And because we've all adjusted to a world where we're all talking to our, parents and grandparents and children and, cousins on Zoom, it's not that big a leap as much as it might have felt in February or something.
Well, we've been getting, I live in Prince Edward County, and we've been getting lots of inquiries from, I don't know how to call them, urban creative people, but we do not have an incredibly robust internet option right now, but they're still coming. They're still coming to the county. They're buying their homes. Is there a solution there?
I mean, I think that if enough come, the market will demand a solution because there'll be enough people to pay for it. I mean, this is not, again, not a new issue. Nordicity and others have been working for years to try to find ways or advise governments to find ways to provide good high-speed internet, you know, reliable, good, high-end high-speed internet to rural communities around Canada. But if you get enough people with enough disposable income that move to those rural communities, maybe you start to see some change. I'm not convinced that you will, though. I mean, I think that it probably will require additional government intervention to ensure that you do get good internet in the county and that, you know, we can both watch Netflix when I'm over. I think that will probably require something like looking at the internet as we look at power.
It's
a public utility with a public utility with sort of service standards, right? Where it wouldn't be acceptable if, you know, you got less power to your house than I get in Toronto and you could only run, you know, a microwave and I could run, you know, a full stereo system, right? Or a full, like, you know, electric heaters and whatnot. We wouldn't view that as acceptable. But somehow when we look at the internet, we think that's acceptable. And I think, I think that change is probably necessary. I think that more people working from home will probably get us there.
So rural internet, rural broadband and cell gap coverage, or the absence thereof, it is a big deal. We just chatted about that a little bit. And you're saying that the market is how we'll get there more quickly. Are there technologies that might help us, like, you know, 5G maybe do we need to change the market itself? Is the market competitive enough?
Yeah. So I think that the market will help, but as I said, I don't think the market is going to be sufficient. Right. I think the market you need a hook, you need something, you need a promise that there might be a good idea for some company to do it. Because we don't have a public telecom operator. So there has to be a private entity that does it. But it has not thus far been economical to do so. And 5G probably doesn't change that. It is less expensive to install 5G in a location than it is to put a bunch of fiber optic cables in the ground, absolutely. But, you know, if you don't have population density to warrant the of people who will actually subscribe to that service in that area, why would you do it? Unless there was a government intervention that said, okay, there needs to be a service standard and you need to do this. And I don't care how you get them good high-speed internet, but you need to do it.
Yeah.
And that's how we do with power. Like, no one says you have to build a tower here. They say you have to service these people with power. And I think that's probably how it would go, how it's likely to go. And that's, you know, it's funny because you sort of think about competition in the marketplace and whether more competition will lead to that. I don't think it's a matter of competition. I think there's the fundamental economics of, you know, there simply not being enough people to pay for a service in the place that you want to install a service is not likely to change. But it will get better, right? Because of those creative people who are going to demand that those services as they move to Prince Edward County or to Bancroft, as I said earlier, to wherever.
Okay. Now, so we spent a little bit of time talking about the relative advantage of IP ownership and COVID-19 and impact. Is that the magic bullet or the silver bullet or whatever you call it? Is IP ownership in the future?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm hesitant to call anything, as we all should be, a magic bullet or a panacea, because not one thing solves every problem ever. But it is, in my view, was the most important issue pre-COVID. I think I remember having a conversation with an industry colleague on like March 12th. You know, we knew COVID was happening, but we didn't know it was going to do what it was eventually going to do. And it was all about the importance and the primacy of owning your intellectual property. And to me, that question is really a matter of whether or not there is such a thing as a domestic market in Canada anymore. Or whether or not Canadian companies, regardless of what they're doing, are creating content for a global audience. Not one global audience, but a series of global audiences or audiences wherever they are. And as I think through those pieces of Canadian intellectual property that have done the best, they are simultaneously universal and uniquely Canadian. I mean, we can't have a conversation about Canadian media and Canadian intellectual property right now without talking about Schitt's Creek. It just won a bajillion Emmys.
Yeah.
Like all of the possible Emmys that it could have won, it won, right? It's a uniquely Canadian show. So like it kind of touches on like
Schitt's Creek. Kind of a family project.
But yeah, so it's uniquely Canadian. It's a piece of intellectual property that was incubated in the public service broadcaster that was then able to find its global audience and then make some significant revenue for the people who own its intellectual property, right? So that is a good example. It's not replicable because there's only one Dan Levy in the world and there's only one Eugene Levy in the world, only one Catherine McKenna in the world. So you can't make another one of those. But I think as a concept, it's the, like, that is the future of Canadian, of Canadian, sort of linear media, I think.
Yeah.
And it's kind of always been like, it's sort of fundamental basis of capitalism, right? Whether or not we like capitalism, we happen to be in a capitalistic mode at this point. And it has always been true that whoever owns the
intellectual property,
the property,
right?
Whoever owns the stuff makes the money,
right?
Right. And so what we were in a situation, what we have always been in Canada, or to some degree and been in Canada, is, you know, a part of our system works on what, you know, in my less charitable days, I call a production treadmill, right? Where we do production because it needs to be done. Because we, you know, the broadcasters need to satisfy their terms of license. So they create content in order to satisfy the terms of license, not in order to, you know, create audiences or to monetize audiences.
They're going for tonnage.
And then they do other things to go for audiences and generate, you know, they pour money into great shows like Transplant, which is a great show, uniquely Canadian, and those shows do rather well, but then they fill up the rest of their things with tonnage. And I think that is a legacy of a world where there was a division between a domestic market and a global market. But the platforms, the things that are stimulating the demand for this content, are global platforms. So there's a disconnect there. And I think that the way that we benefit the most in that is when Canadian companies and Canadians have a strong presence on those platforms by having really strong content on those platforms. So back to your question about that $88 million, one of the things that, you know, CMF and Telefilm have been doing is investing in the creation of that intellectual property. And that's, to me, that's where the smart money is.
Okay.
So that's, and it is always, you know, it was again, back to the whole theme of things that were once true, they're just more true. That was true pre-COVID. And it's now the companies that have that content that are able to continue to sell that content in the middle of a pandemic that are the ones doing the best.
So the 1-2 punch is be an internet service provider and own a lot of intellectual property.
Well, if you do that, you're probably pretty good. So, Bell and Rogers, high five, you're doing fine. But, I mean, I think, all facetiousness aside, I do think that those are, that if you're going to be a media company, and we've done work with CMPA and others to look at exactly this thing, but the what makes a media company profitable is the ability to distribute catalog. That was true 5 years ago. It's just more true.
Yeah.
Because you can't get the producer fees because you can't get on set.
Right.
Right. So, I think the precarity of that treadmill, which would work for a lot of people for a long time and created a lot of jobs and did a lot of good in that way. The precarity of it is now sort of exposed in COVID.
So does this lead to consolidation in the industry?
That would be the logical consequence, right? It would logically lead to people buying each other's catalog. And, would sort of imagine that you would end up with something that looks more like the UK, with what they call in the UK the super indies, that have enough market scale to be able to extract pretty good deals from, you know, the Amazons and Netflix and so forth that they're making deals with to get to the final leg to the consumer. But that's probably you've already started to see that in Canada, Nine-Story Buying, catalog. So there's that consolidation has, has already started to be, you know, start to be a thing.
Okay. All right, son. I'm Christian. We're getting near the end of the conversation on this cart.ca podcast, and pretty interesting stuff. But I wanted to see, and I always do in these conversations, I want to see if there's something that I've forgotten to ask. Is there a question or a point that you would want to assure our cart.ca listeners that they take away from this conversation that we just haven't touched on? Is there anything you want to share now?
Well, I guess there's probably one of each. One thing I want one key takeaway for me is the importance of Canadian stories and the importance and the sort of, you know, time to be confident about telling those Canadian stories. I mentioned Schitt's Creek, could have mentioned Kim's Convenience, could have mentioned End with a Knee, could have mentioned Trailer Park Boys,
Murdoch Mysteries.
These are all things that could only come out of Canada. And the time where we try to be Chicago in Toronto is over, and it needs to be over for us to be able to succeed in a global marketplace. We need to become the Swedes and know what we know and be authentic to ourselves, and then, you know, damn the guns, put it out to the world. So I think that's the key takeaway for me. And a lot of you've seen me come back to that point a number of times. The part that we didn't talk about, I alluded to only once, is the diversity, inclusion, and equity angle. I think that, when we start distributing funds, when people start clamoring for help, people who already got the help before are the ones who are going to get the most help. And that's always true. That may have been the case in the midst of COVID. So I think, as we think about building back better, that needs to be part of the conversation, and not just part of a conversation, but, you know, part of changing the structure of how we think about funding content in Canada, even to the point where we at least should know how much of our funding goes to, you know, Black, Indigenous, people of color, women, anyone. Okay. We just don't know.
In your imagination, can you imagine a specific example of how we would do that?
I do. I won't get into too many details because I'm still working this out with the parties at hand.
Yeah.
As part of my work with REMC, as I mentioned earlier. But I do think, though, that there is an organization in Canada that already tracks what key creatives go into every production that receives a tax credit. It's the Canadian Audiovisual Certification Office. So I would imagine that a solution to this problem is simply understanding we already know who all the key creatives are, but if we can have those key creatives self-identify as whatever they want, and then be able to store that information securely and report on it on an annual basis, we'd at least know where we were.
So it's Cavco?
Cavco, yeah. So I think Cavco will likely play a strong role in the mechanism.
Stay tuned.
Let's hope. There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of institutional momentum that wants to keep, not any individuals. It's just people trying to do what their job was yesterday, tomorrow, and that's understandable. But if everybody thinks that way, nothing ever changes.
All right.
So that's what I'll leave it there.
Well, thank you very much, son. Thank you, Christian. Needless to say, I'm very proud of you. You're doing good stuff.
Proud of you too, Dad.
Thank you. I'm Bill Roberts for cart.ca, and I've been joined today by Christian Roberts, managing partner at Nordicity and father of my grandson, Oscar. Hope you've enjoyed the podcast. Be well, everyone. Cheers.